and second or third generation families were upset about rising school taxes. Some of them organized, and for the first time in memory, the school budget failed. In New York State, the school gets a second vote. But if that fails as well, the mandated cuts are quite draconian, with essential programs cut without thoughtful prioritization. With only 8 days before the next vote, what could be done? A few activists decided to try a new approach. Instead of arguing vociferously in favor of the budget, instead of passing out flyers or holding a rally, they tied 100 blue ribbons to a big tree in front of the middle school, right in the center of town. Within days, the idea had spread. In the week before the election, many dozens of trees all around town had blue ribbons hanging from them. Thousands of blue ribbons hung by dozens of families. The message was simple. People like us, people in our town, people in this blue ribbon district, support our schools. The budget passed 2-1. The internal narrative. We don't make decisions in a vacuum. Instead, we base them on our perception of our cohort. So we buy a $700 baby stroller because we're smart, or we don't because it's stupid. Or we shop at the local farmer's market, or we don't because it's raining and they don't sell Cheetos. We harass the female TV reporter outside the soccer stadium and lose our jobs, because that's how we see our people behaving. Or we wear a bright pink shirt, yellow trousers, and no socks because, we tell ourselves, they're comfortable. But mostly, it's because that's how we imagine a successful version of ourselves. It's all built around the simple question, do people like me do things like this? Normalization creates culture, and culture drives our choices, which leads to more normalization. Marketers don't make average stuff for average people. Marketers make change, and they do it by normalizing new behaviors. Defining us. In the previous era, mass media worked hard to define us as all of us, as the crowd, the Americans, the people of the world. All of us never totally succeeded because the racists and the xenophobes and the isolated were happy to draw the line somewhere short of all of us. It got very close, though. I'd like to teach the world to sing, and the commercialization of the entire world happened faster and more deeply than most people expected. We mostly all watched Johnny Carson, and we mostly all wore jeans, and we mostly all went to school. At least the all that stretched as far as we were willing to see. Today, though, popular culture isn't as popular as it used to be. Mad Men, which was hyped by the New York Times in dozens of articles in just one season, was only regularly seen by 1% of the U.S. population. And the popular culture phenomenon that is the cronut, or the deep-fried Oreo at the county fair, or the raw moon pie at the funky restaurant, these phenomena reach, if you're willing to do a little rounding, basically no one. We've gone from all of us being everyone to all of us being no one. But that's okay, because the long tail of culture and the media and change doesn't need everyone any longer. It's happy with enough. Which us? In People Like Us Do Things Like This, the us matters. The more specific, the more connected, the tighter the us, the better. What the marketer, the leader, and the organizer must do as their first job is simple. Define us. When you say, people like us donate to a charity like this one, you're clearly not saying it to everyone. Everyone is not going to give to your charity. So, who is? The right answer is not, the people who give are people like us. That's backwards. We need to be braver than that, more articulate, more willing to take initiative in not only reaching our markets, but changing them, changing their expectations, and most of all, changing what they choose to tell and show each other. The same calculus applies in the internal meeting where you're pitching a new idea to your company, or the business-to-business sales call you're making, or the way you hope to shift the culture of the soccer team you coach. Begin with us. It shouldn't be called the culture. It should be called a culture or this culture, because there is no universal culture, no us that defines all of us. When we're comfortable realizing that our work is to change a culture, then we can begin to do two bits of hard work. One, map and understand the worldview of the culture we seek to change. Two, focus all our energy on this group. Ignore everyone else. Instead, focus on building and living a story that will resonate with the culture we are seeking to change. That's how we make change, by caring enough to want to change a culture, and by being brave enough to pick just one. Just enough art. Entrepreneur Alex Samuel points out that when JetBlue launched, it simply had to be hipper than American and Delta. But when Virgin America launched 6 years later, it had to be hipper than JetBlue. That's a different hurdle. After all, JetBlue had worked hard to be hip. The bar had been raised. Everything in our culture is part of a hierarchy between yesterday, today, and tomorrow. We don't get to jump all the way ahead. Photography works this way, for example. It's quite easy to be the photographer who is skilled enough to take yesterday's pictures. Previous styles are technically easy to mimic. That's straightforward. But to be the one who establishes the next phase takes a leap into a new way of doing something, just a bit better and a bit unexpected. Leap too far, though, and the tribe won't follow. Case study, gay marriage in Ireland. One way to pass the world's first national referendum about the right for gay people to marry would be to state your case, to focus on fairness, respect, and civil rights. That rational approach won't get you very far, though. An alternative? Bridget White and her husband Paddy, both nearly 80, made a video about their son and about what it meant to them to support the referendum. People like us. It's easy for some to watch that video and see themselves as parents, as traditionalists, as Irishmen. The essence of political change is almost always cultural change, and the culture changes horizontally. Person to person, us to us. Elite and or exclusive. Malcolm Gladwell pointed out that there's a difference between an elite institution and an exclusive one. They can coexist, but often don't. The Rhodes Scholarship is an elite award. It goes to few people, and it's respected by other elite individuals and institutions. Elite is an external measure. Does the world you care about respect this badge? But the Rhodes Scholarship isn't exclusive. It's not a tribe, a group of well-connected individuals with their own culture. Exclusive is an internal measure. It's us versus them, insiders versus outsiders. The Hell's Angels aren't elite, but they're exclusive. Harvard Business School is both elite and exclusive. So are the Navy SEALs. It's easy to get confused in our quest to build something that matters. It seems as though we ought to work to make our organization elite, to let the New York Times proclaim that our opera is worth seeing, or to hope that the upperclassmen will like our performance on the field. In fact, though, it's exclusive institutions that change things. We have no control over our elite status, and it can be taken away in an instant. But exclusive organizations thrive as long as their members wish to belong, and that work is something we can control. At the heart of the exclusive organization is a simple truth. Every member is people like us. Sign up for that and you gain status. Walk away and you lose it. In order to change a culture, we begin with an exclusive cohort. That's where we can offer the most tension and create the most useful connections. Case study, Robinhood Foundation. In 2015, the Robinhood Foundation raised $101 million in one night. It was the single most effective fundraiser of its kind in history. Some people look at this result and conclude that the tactic, a gala, is the secret. It's not. It's the extraordinary peer pressure of people like us do things like this. Robinhood is a New York charity, supported largely by donations from wealthy hedge fund and Wall Street investors. The foundation has spent a generation building expectations about this event, carefully spreading the word about the generosity of the early adopters while playing into the hyper-competitive egomania of Wall Street. While there were a few anonymous gifts, almost all the money raised revolved around a simple trade, cash for status. Tension is created by the event. You're there, your peers are there, your spouse is there. An auction is taking place. The cause is a good one. With a simple act, you can raise your profile, earn respect, and dominate the competition. If that matches your worldview and you believe you can afford it, then money is raised. Over the years, this narrative is normalized. It's not extreme, not for this us. Instead, it's what we do. The intentional nature of this process is easily overlooked. It rarely happens as an unintentional side effect. The standing ovation. How many people are needed to start a standing ovation? At TED, it only takes three. If Bill and Al and Sonny leap to their feet, thousands of others will as well. At a Broadway show, no matter how tepid the response, 15 strangers spread throughout the theater might be enough. And at Mesro, the awesome jazz club, it's probably not possible. So what's going on? In some audiences, there are few strangers. We recognize and respect those around us and our trust of these people, together with our deeply felt need to fit in, combine to activate a standing ovation. If I desire to be one of us and the leader is standing, well, I'll stand too. On the other hand, in a venue of strangers, our desire to fit in is a bit different. At the Broadway Theater, I'm wearing the tourist hat, and tourists like me respond in ways like this. The venue has a bias. And the opposite is true among the hardcore jazz fans. They know that jazz fans don't give standing ovations, not in a club, and the bias of the venue is difficult to change. Roots and shoots. Here's an analogy that helps bring to life the ideas we've covered so far. Your work is a tree. The roots live in the soil of dreams and desires. Not the dreams and desires of everyone, simply those you seek to serve. If your work is simply a commodity, a quick response to an obvious demand, then your roots don't run deep. It's unlikely that your tree will grow. Or even if it does, it's unlikely to be seen as important, useful, or dominant. It will be crowded out by all the similar trees. As your tree grows, it creates a beacon for the community. The early adopters among the people you seek to serve can engage with the tree, climb it, use it for shade, and eventually eat the fruits. And they attract the others. If you have planned well, the tree will quickly grow taller because the sun isn't being blocked. There are a few other trees in the same area. As the tree grows, it not only attracts other people, but its height, as the dominant choice in the neighborhood, blocks out the futile efforts of other similar trees. The market likes a winner. It's a mistake to show up with an acorn and expect a crowd. Work that matters for people who care is the shortest, most direct route to making a difference. Chapter 10. Trust and tension create forward motion. Pattern match, pattern interrupt. You're going to do one or the other. The pattern match is business as usual. When the offering you bring matches the story we tell ourselves, the way we tell it, the pace we're used to, the expense and the risk, it's an easy choice to add you to the mix. Consider the family with young kids that's used to a never-ending parade of breakfast cereals. Cocoa Krispies led to Lucky Charms, led to Frosted Flakes. Whichever one is on sale or has a cool promo that a kid yells about. When your new brand of cereal shows up, buying it is a pattern match. Sure, why not? Or it might be as simple as a sitcom on Thursday night at 9 p.m. Millions sit down every week to watch TV. You're not trying to change their pattern. You're simply putting your new offering into the mix that already exists. A pattern interrupt, on the other hand, requires some sort of jolt. Tension is created and energy is diverted to consider this new input. Is it something worth considering? Most of the time, for most of those you seek to reach, the answer is no. The answer is no because the patterns are established. Time is precious, and risk is something to be feared. If you want someone who has never hired a gardener to hire you to be their gardener, you're asking for a pattern interrupt. If you are trying to secure a $5,000 donation from a wealthy person who habitually makes $100 donations to charity, you face the same challenge. The pattern requires undoing before you can earn forward motion. When life interferes, new patterns are established. This is why it's so profitable to market to new dads, engaged women, and people who have recently moved. They don't have a pattern to match, so it's all an interrupt. On the other hand, the purchasing manager at a typical organization has been taught that matching the pattern is the best way to keep a steady job with no surprises. The best time to market a new app is when the platform is brand new. When you market to someone who doesn't have a pattern yet, you don't have to persuade them that their old choices were mistakes. Tension can change patterns. If you're going to market a pattern interrupt, it will require you to provide the kind of tension that can only be released by being willing to change an ingrained pattern. Tension is the force on a stretched rubber band. Pull it at one end, and it creates tension at every point. Why do some people hesitate to ask a question during a class, but will happily answer the professor if they're called on? Volunteering is a problem for them, because it requires agency and responsibility. But when the teacher applies focused social tension in the form of publicly calling on a student, that student has no problem answering. The tension was sufficient to overcome his or her inertia. We create tension when we ask someone to contribute to the bake sale or join our book club. We're using one force, in this case, social engagement, to overcome another force, the status quo. For an example, let's consider Slack, the fast-growing productivity software designed for teams at work. Very few people have a pattern of changing the way they work all day. No one wakes up in the morning hoping that they'll need to learn a new software program and deal with the hassle for weeks as they shift from a trusted platform to a new one. And yet, Slack is the fastest growing product of its kind. How? Because after capturing the energy and affection of some neophiliacs, the ratchet kicked in. Using Slack is better when your coworkers use it. So existing users have a powerful, selfish reason to tell the others. And in fact, every day they don't is painful for them. And what about the pattern interrupt for the new user? Where is the tension? Simple. A colleague says, you're missing out. Every day you're not on Slack, people at work are talking about you behind your back, working on projects without you, having conversations you're excluded from. You can release that tension right now, simply by signing in. Slack began by doing a pattern match, offering new software to people who like new software, a new way of doing work for people looking for a new way of doing work. But then came the leap. They gave this group a tool to create a pattern interrupt, peer to peer, one worker saying to another, "We're going to try this new tool." That single horizontal transmission built a multi-billion dollar software company. It's not accidental. It's built into the software itself. What pattern are you interrupting? What are you breaking? Launch a new product, and in addition to serving your audience, you'll be breaking something. The very existence of an alternative causes something else to no longer be true. When you launch the second hotel in Niagara Falls, the first hotel is no longer the one and only. When you launch the telephone, the telegraph is no longer the fastest way to send a message. When you host an exclusive party, the people who aren't invited become outsiders. When you launch an extreme, the most efficient, the least expensive, the most convenient, then whatever you've exceeded is no longer the extreme that its fans sought out. When a new network begins to gain traction, bringing in the cool kids, the powerful early adopters, this traction causes everyone who is part of the old network you're supplanting to reconsider their allegiance. This is what tension feels like, the tension of being left behind. And marketers who cause change cause tension. Tension is not the same as fear. If you feel like you're coercing people manipulating them, or causing them to be afraid, you're probably doing it wrong. But tension is different. Tension is something we can do precisely because we care about those we seek to serve. Fear is a dream killer. It puts people into suspended animation, holding their breath, paralyzed, and unable to move forward. Fear alone isn't going to help you make change happen. Tension might, though. The tension we face anytime we're about to cross a threshold. The tension of this might work versus this might not work. The tension of, if I learn this, will I like who I become? There might be fear, but tension is the promise that we can get through that fear to the other side. Tension is the hallmark of a great educational experience. The tension of not quite knowing where we are in the process, not being sure of the curriculum, not having a guarantee that the insight we seek is about to happen. All effective education creates tension, because just before you learn something, you're aware you don't know it yet. As adults, we willingly expose ourselves to the tension of a great jazz concert, or a baseball game, or a thrilling movie. But mostly, because we've been indoctrinated by fear, we hesitate when we have the opportunity to learn something new on our way to becoming the person we seek to be. Fear will paralyze us if we haven't been taught that forward motion is possible. Once we see a way out, the tension can be the tool that moves us. Effective marketers have the courage to create tension. Some actively seek out this tension because it works. It pushes those you serve over the chasm to the other side. If you care enough about the change you seek to make, you will care enough to generously and respectfully create tension on behalf of that change. Marketers create tension, and forward motion relieves that tension. The logic of the going out of business sale is elusive. After all, if the store was any good, it wouldn't be going out of business. And if a customer is hoping for support, a warranty, or a chance for a return, buying something from a store that's about to disappear isn't very smart. And yet, people can't resist a bargain. That's because the scarcity of the going out of business sale creates tension. The tension of, what bargains did I miss? The best way to relieve that tension is to go to the store and check it out. Of course, the fear of missing out on a bankruptcy isn't the only tension that drives us forward. Here's a new social app. If you get in early, you'll find more friends and be more in sync than the people who come later. Better not fall behind. Here's how we process the invoices here. I know you're familiar with the original system, but our organization uses the new one, and you'll need to be good at it by Thursday. The last three houses that sold on our block went for less than anyone expected. If we don't sell soon, we'll never be able to cover our mortgage. Supreme is only making 250 of these sneakers. I'm getting a pair. Are you coming? If you want to find out how the series ends, you'll need to tune in on Sunday. We don't want to feel left out, left behind, uninformed, or impotent. We want to get ahead. We want to be in sync. We want to do what people like us are doing. None of those feelings existed before a marketer showed up with something that caused them. If there weren't a new album, you wouldn't feel left out if you hadn't heard it yet. We intentionally create these gaps, these little canyons of tension that people find themselves leaping over. And the reason is status. Where do we stand? What does the tribe think of us? Who's up and who's down? Are you ready to create tension? It's not a rhetorical question. There are two ways to do your work. You can be a cab driver. Show up and ask someone where they want to go. Charge them based on the meter. Be a replaceable cog in the on-demand transport system. You might be a harder working cabbie, but it won't change much. Or you can be an agent of change, someone who creates tension and then relieves it. When they started building fancy casinos in Las Vegas, it created tension for countless travelers. Visitors who just a year earlier were happy in Reno or in downtown Las Vegas now felt like second-class citizens. They asked, "Am I the sort of person who goes to a casino this run down?" The very existence of a fancier alternative degraded their experience at their former favorite. Tension is created, and the only way to relieve that tension is with forward motion. When you arrive on the scene with your story, with the solution you have in mind, do you also create tension? If you don't, the status quo is likely to survive. How the status quo got that way. The dominant narrative, the market share leader, the policies and procedures that rule the day, they all exist for a reason. They're good at resisting efforts by insurgents like you. If all it took to upend the status quo was the truth, we would have changed a long time ago. If all we were waiting for was a better idea, a simpler solution, or a more efficient procedure, we would have shifted away from the status quo a year or a decade or a century ago. The status quo doesn't shift because you're right. It shifts because the culture changes. And the engine of culture is status. Chapter 11. Status, Dominance, and Affiliation. Baxter hates Truman. Baxter's my dog. He's a mutt, a gregarious, happy, expressive dog who manages to get along with just about every human and dog he meets. Except for Truman. Truman is the regal, self-assured German shepherd who just moved in across the street. Truman's got a loving family. He goes for walks a few times a day, and he's driving Baxter crazy. When Truman's fabulous family came over for dinner, they brought Truman along. Baxter freaked out. He couldn't control himself. What's up with that? Consider the penguins in the Galapagos. They spend about 2 hours a day fishing, and the rest of the time organizing themselves into a pecking order. There's an enormous amount of social grooming, of bumping, of social positioning. And it's not just my dog and the penguins, of course. It's us as well. It's not irrational. Status makes it the right choice. Why do people choose one restaurant over another, one college? Why drive this car and not that one? Why did that poker champion make a bad bet? Why rent a house instead of buying one? What club do you belong to? If you look closely at decisions that don't initially make sense, you'll likely see status roles at work. The decision didn't make sense to you, but it made perfect sense to the person who made it. We spend a lot of time paying attention to status. Status roles, the Godfather and the Undertaker. In his brilliant book, Impro, Keith Johnstone helps us understand status roles, the hidden but obvious drivers of all elements of culture. There's always an alpha dog in the pack, and every litter has a runt. Status roles determine who gets to eat first in the lion pack and who gets to drink first at the oasis. In human culture, status roles are everywhere that more than one human is present. They exist in dating, who picks up the check, and in the boardroom. Who comes in first? Who sits where? Who speaks? Who decides? Who's responsible? My favorite example, one that captures the essence of John Stone's point, is easily found if you visit YouTube and search for the opening scene of The Godfather. In the scene, Amerigo Bonasera, the undertaker, a washed-out, tired, small man in a nondescript black suit, comes to visit the Godfather on the Don's daughter's wedding day. In just a few seconds, the stage is already set. The low-status Bonasera, how could he be lower, comes to visit the high-status Don Corleone, a man who has spent his entire life ensuring that he is on top of the status heap. On this wedding day, though, the tradition is that the Godfather must grant any favor that is asked. Over the course of just a few minutes of film, the universe is upended. Bonasera asks Don Corleone to do violence to the men who have harmed his daughter. Family ties drive him to take a huge risk, to raise his status at the expense of the Godfather. To make things worse, he even offers to pay Corleone, transforming a patriarch into a hoodlum. Oh, the tension. In that moment, the undertaker's life is in jeopardy. He has gone too far. Parental pride has pushed him into a zone where the Godfather can't possibly operate. The Godfather can't grant this favor and maintain his status. And status is his lifeblood. Through some remarkable directing jujitsu, in just a few seconds, the normal order is restored, and the scene ends with the undertaker bowing to the Don and kissing his ring, pledging fealty. Bonasera relieves the tension by returning to his place in the status hierarchy. Status lets us. Status is our position in the hierarchy. It's also our perception of that position. Status protects us. Status helps us get what we want. Status gives us the leverage to make change happen. Status is a place to hide. Status can be a gift or a burden. Status creates a narrative that changes our perceived options, alters our choices, and undermines or supports our future. And the desire to change our status or to protect it drives almost everything we do. Case study, lions and Maasai warriors. How do we save the lions of Kenya and Tanzania? Conservation biologist Leela Hazzah saw how encroachments on their environment were making it more difficult for the lions to survive. But she also knew that among many Maasai, a rite of passage for adolescent males was to single-handedly kill a lion. This show of bravery was putting significant pressure on the lion population. It's estimated that there are only 30,000 lions in the region, down from 200,000 a generation or two ago. All the rational arguments in the world aren't powerful enough to change deeply held cultural beliefs, even in this community. The need for status, as a parent, as a young adult, is within all of us. Instead, Dr. Hazzah and her team worked to create new cultural beliefs built on top of basic human desires. As we learned from the quarter-inch drill bit, the action isn't always obviously connected with the desired emotion. In the case of the Maasai, the cultural goals are to bind the community to each other, to create feelings of empowerment and possibility, to inculcate bravery and patience, and to have a significant rite of passage, to raise the status of the boy as he becomes a man. None of these goals are directly related to killing a lion. That was simply a historical artifact. Working with and within the Maasai cultural systems, Dr. Hazzah and her team introduced a new rite of passage and built cultural influences around it. Instead of demonstrating bravery and patience by killing a lion, the young members of the culture now demonstrate those skills by saving one. In their words, wildlife conservation has traditionally focused on wildlife, not people. At Lion Guardians, we take the opposite approach. For almost a decade, we have worked with local communities to protect lions and improve community conservation by blending traditional knowledge and culture with science. Now, the Maasai find and name lions, track them, and use radio telemetry to perform a census. Protecting a lion has become as much of a rite of passage as killing one used to be. The status dynamic is always at work. Once seen, it can't be unseen. Say a cop pulls over a motorist for running a stop sign. Who has status in that situation? That same motorist goes on to the office, where he barks orders at the receptionist. Who has status? A clash of status roles happens in any bureaucracy that only knows how to measure today's status changes. The roles we easily adopt at school, the class clown, the big man on campus, the A student, are status roles. And remember how hard we defended those roles, even when we had a chance to change them. When the marketer shows up with her new idea, her opportunity, the offer to make change happen, every time, it's a challenge to our status. We have the choice to accept and move up or down, depending on the story we tell ourselves, or to turn down the offer and live with the tension of walking away. It's a mistake to believe that everyone wants to make their status higher. In fact, few people do. It's also a mistake to believe that no one wants to make their status lower. If you've been conditioned to see yourself in a certain status role, you might fight to maintain or even lower your status. The smart marketer begins to realize that some people are open and hungry for a shift in status, up or down, while others will fight like crazy to maintain their roles. Status is not the same as wealth. In some circles, a Pulitzer-winning columnist has far more status than I do. A doctor in charge of a prestigious hospital might have more status than a wealthy plastic surgeon. And the penniless yogi in a little village in India has more status than the richest man in town, at least to some of his peers. In the last few decades, we've gotten lazier in our nuance of awarding status, preferring it to be related to either the dollars in a bank account or the number of followers online. But status continues to take many forms. Six things about status. 1. Status is always relative. Unlike eyesight or strength or your bank balance, it doesn't matter where you are on the absolute scale. Instead, it's about perception of status relative to others in the group. 6 is bigger than 4, but lower than 11. There is no highest number. 2. Status is in the eyes of the beholder. If you are seen as low status by outsiders, but as high status in your own narrative, then both things are true at different times to different people. 3. Status attended to is the status that matters. Status is most relevant when we try to keep it or change it. For many people, status is upmost in our minds in every interaction. But it only matters when the person we're engaging with cares about status. 4. Status has inertia. We're more likely to work to maintain our status, high or low, than we are to try to change it. 5. Status is learned. Our beliefs about status start early, and yet the cohort we are with can influence our perception of our status in very little time. 6. Shame is the status killer. The reason that shame is used as a lever is simple. It works. If we accept the shame someone sends our way, it undermines our entire narrative about relative status. We adjust our status constantly, intuitively playing with it based on the situation. And when you bring your work to the market, nothing is considered before status roles. Frank Sinatra had more than a cold. Frank Sinatra lived two lives, deeply in conflict with one another. As chronicled by Gay Talese, the outside world saw him at an apex, the definition of suave and sophisticated. He was a high-status power broker, a serious man, the one and only. When Frank looked in the mirror, though, he saw a low-status, skinny kid, disrespected, barely holding on to what he had. He surrounded himself with yes-men and sycophants, but still managed to have self-sabotaging tantrums and a miserable life that belied his fame, fortune, and good health. When we bring status into our marketing, we are walking on very thin ice. We don't know if the person we're engaging with appears to have high status and doesn't believe it, or actually believes and wants to increase his standing. But it's not clear that we have much choice, because every big decision is made based on our perceptions of status. Learning to see status. The idea of status isn't nearly as simple as it appears. Consider, for those you seek to serve, their external status, how they are seen by their chosen community, and their internal status, who they see when they look in the mirror. Next, work through how they maintain or seek to change that status. Do they belittle others, seek approval, help in selfless ways, drive themselves to achieve more? What sort of wins and losses do they track? Consider the following two XY grids. You can see them at seths.blog/charts. People in the top right quadrant, A, are rare indeed. This space belongs to people who are seen as powerful and who also see themselves as able to handle it. I'd put Oprah Winfrey in this category. This is the person who is able to choose, not the one who is waiting to be chosen. The top left quadrant, D, is more common, since people who end up with high status often doubt themselves. This can turn them into divas. The best stories about Frank Sinatra are about the juxtaposition of his perceived royalty status with his own need for affirmation. Imposter syndrome lies here. The bottom right quadrant, B, it's for people who see themselves as far better than the rest of the world does. This is where you can find artistic drive and a willingness to strive for better. But over time, it can also lead to bitterness. And finally, the bottom left quadrant, C, is where we categorize people who see themselves as undeserving and the world agrees. While this appears to be a sad place, it's also a consistent one, which is why we've embedded this role in the hierarchical culture. This is Cinderella before the ball, never expecting a chance for more. This is the coal miner, fighting to keep a dangerous, low-paying job. Before we do the analysis, though, there's one more grid. In many interactions, people seek to change their relative status, either to adjust themselves up in comparison to their peers, or to seek safety by giving up and moving down. Moving down creates safety because there's more room and less threat. Fewer people jostle here for a better view or the chance to eat lunch first. People are intensely aware of their relative status. We can move up or down. We can do that by helping pushing others up or down. We can open the door for others and enable them to increase their status. Or we can spend time denigrating others or increasing our own status. In quadrant one, We see the philanthropist, the committed teacher, and the social justice proponent. She seeks to improve her status with others by demonstrating the power to focus on those with low status instead of herself. This is certainly how Superman came to be understood by us. He could rob banks, but he saves lives instead. In quadrant two, we see similar behavior for a different reason. This is the person who not only lets other people ahead in line, but doesn't even bother to try out for a role because others are more deserving. Quadrant three is the antisocial character who presents a noxious, infantile narcissism to the world. He's angry. He knows he can't measure up, but he's going to take down everyone around him. O.J. Simpson and Martin Shkreli are here. And quadrant four is the hard-charging, selfish person who desperately wants to win every engagement and who is willing to do it with a combination of creating value and tearing down the competition. Different stories for different people. We each have our own narratives, the noise in our head, the worldview that is unique to us, the history and beliefs and perceptions that shape who we are and what we choose. And Sonder is the generous act of accepting that others don't want, believe, or know what we do and have a similar noise in their heads. But in order to bring our change to the world, we need to make some assumptions about what others believe. We can't hear the noise in their heads, but we can watch what they do and make some guesses. There is a schism in our culture. In various moments, there are two sides that tell themselves very different stories and act them out in different ways. One, the populations that default, in certain settings, to dominion, and two, those that seek affiliation. Affiliation and dominion are different ways to measure status. Every search on nicest guy in Hollywood brings up a picture of Tom Hanks, and every search on The Godfather brings us a picture of the fictional Don Corleone. Tom Hanks cares about affiliation. Don Corleone measured domination instead. Seeing the difference unlocks an understanding of our world, our political landscape, and how your customers might see things. This section of our journey is filled with personas, narratives, and exaggerations about each worldview. Affiliation. The questions that someone who cares about affiliation asks himself and those around him. Who knows you? Who trusts you? Have you made things better? What is your circle like? Where do you stand within the tribe? Can't we all get along? Dominion. The questions and statements that someone who cares about dominion offers to himself and those around him. This is mine, not yours. Who has more power? I did this myself. My family needs more of what we already have. My side dominating your side means I don't have to be in charge, as long as my leader is winning. On the ball field, a 12-year-old might care about nothing but winning. And not just winning, but beating the opposition. He'll impugn the referee's motives, stomp on toes, and hold nothing back in order to win. That same kid doesn't care at all about being at the top of his class, but he cares a lot about who sits next to him on the bus. In the jazz band, someone is keeping track of how many solos he gets, and someone else wants to be sure she's helping keep the group in sync. The people you're seeking to serve in this moment, what are they measuring? If you want to market to someone who measures dominion or affiliation, you'll need to be aware of what's being measured and why. Who eats first and who sits closest to the emperor are questions that persist to this day. Both are status questions. One involves dominion, the other involves affiliation. not simply eating first, but being on the same team as the person who eats first, and getting pleasure out of watching others eat last. Not simply sitting near the emperor, but knowing that you'll be in his good graces and those of the rest of the royal court tomorrow as well. Which is the narrative your audience resonates with? Learning from pro wrestling. What is pro wrestling really but a battle for status? It's not just among the wrestlers, but also among the fans. Because when your hero moves up, so do you. If you can see the lens that pro wrestling and its fans use to see the world while they're at a match, you can understand how some people will view your offering as well. The alternative to dominion is affiliation. One can gain status without an oil well or a factory, and one can enjoy as much status by letting someone into the flow of traffic as they can from cutting him off. This is the status that comes from the community. It is the status of respect in return for contribution, for caring, for seeing and being in sync with others, especially others with no ability to repay you. Modern society, urban society, the society of the internet, the arts, and innovation are all built primarily on affiliation, not dominion. This type of status is not, I'm better, it's, I'm connected, I'm family. And in an economy based on connection, not manufacturing, being a trusted member of the family is priceless. Fashion is usually about affiliation. What are they showing? What is everyone else doing? Is this the season? Within competitive markets, there's a race to be the dominant voice. But among the customers that make up that market, the position of the leader works, because the customers desire to be affiliated with one another. The leader provides a valuable signal, a notice to expect that everyone else will be in sync. The goal isn't winning, it's being part of the group. Sending dominance signals. Uber built its brand on dominance. The first few years of their rollout were marked by contentious relationships with local governments, competitors, and drivers. This signaling aligned with the view of some investors, employees, and users, and permitted them to double down on their story and how it was told. There are some customers, partners, and employees who will respond best to a narrative of winning and losing. What kind of company do you want to work for? People who align with one worldview often have trouble imagining why someone would choose the alternative. Sending affiliation signals. Marketers spend an enormous amount of time and money on the simple task of sending affiliation signals. How busy is the trade show booth? Who else is at the launch party? Who blurbed the book? Are people talking about it? Which is shorthand for, are people like us doing something like this? Affiliation isn't as focused on scarcity as dominion is, because affiliation admires the network effect. More affiliation leads to affiliation for everyone involved. Abundance is welcome. The affiliated marketer seeking leverage works to prime the pump by sending the right signals to the right people in search of a cascade. For an investment bank, that means running the tombstone ads with the names of all the right firms at the bottom. For a business-to-business seller, that means creating referrals. For a local craftsperson, it means hunkering down in a single neighborhood until a reputation is assured. Dominion is a vertical experience, above or below. Affiliation is a horizontal one. Who's standing next to me? Affiliation or dominance is up to the customer, not you. Do you see the world in terms of winners and losers, up and down? Or is it more about insiders and outsiders, being in sync, being part of a movement? The way you see the world isn't nearly as important as the worldview of those you seek to serve. As we've seen, their worldview is always stronger than the story